Reading from The Pirates by George MacDonald Fraser, Chapter the 14th. Cohockle Guzlin was in a fever of excitement that tropic night. In their rude adobe houses, the natives conversed in animated grunts, and for once the usual topic, what went wrong with today's wheels, was forgotten. For had not the great white god come at last, who should provide wheels in abundance as foretold? Had he not been led from the altar before the Princess of the Sun, and had she not risen unsteadily from her litter, tripped on her conga skirt, smitten her forehead, ritually three times with the heel of her hand, while speaking mystic incantations, O God, oh, I got acquit! And sprinkled him with the sacred drinking chocolate as an irrevocable sign of their impending holy nuptials? All had seen her stare at the tall stranger as in an ecstatic trance before she collapsed, sighing on her litter. All female Cohockle Guzlin sighed, for that matter, for the god was magnificent to behold and charming with it. He had borne the princess's hand to his lips and bowed reverently when she goofed off. "Man, we gotta find a new word for cool," the cacique Brasso had admitted. Then the god had quieted the irate clamor of the fair woman whom, in his mysterious wisdom, he had preserved from sacrifice, and indicated that she should be taken with him to the chamber set aside for him in the temple. Thither, too, had gone Brasso with a castaway creature, Shafto, and presently it was known that the god had sent for the Mogwai victim. And just when the plant's razor tip was scratching his sternum, too, Cohockle Guzlin pursed its lips and hoped this divine clemency wasn't going to become a habit. Still, that was gods for you, and no use beefing. Doubtless tomorrow's marriage to the Princess of the Sun would settle him down.
Marriage?
A Pekingese with its tail in the vacuum cleaner could not have equaled Lady Vanity for penetrative power. Lamps in the marble chamber flickered. A hideously painted mask fell off the wall. Cacique Brasso jumped 3 feet. Solomon Shafto dived under a sofa, and even Colonel Blood held on tight to his seat. In a fury of maroon velvet, she let fly again her eyes azure beams of rage.
Marriage! To that cocoa bean in the fruit hat! Never! You would die first!
Avery, alone, had remained unmoved, thumb on chin. "Marriage to the princess, say, Shafto, at dusk tomorrow.
"'Nothing!" decibeled Vanity. "The immortal crust!" She whirled on the uncomprehending Brasso. "Get this, barbarian! Captain Avery is affianced to me, Lady Vanity Rook, of South Street and Torpedo Towers, Bucks, and you can tell Ruddy Minnehaha that if she so much as shakes a feather at him—"
"A moment, sweet," interposed Avery. "'Twere best say naught before this fellow, since though he has no English, yet is thy meaning perilously plain. Master Shafto, be pleased to tell the cacique that I shall present myself to her divine highness at her pleasure." His warning gesture checked Vanity's escaping steam until Brasso had got the message and departed, whereupon the captain resumed, bright-eyed and urgent. "See now, my angel, our straits are dire, and these people fickly dangerous. By humouring them with this marriage, I shall gain us time. 'Tis no more than their superstitious whim, and no harm done, since heathen ceremony can have no force of canon law. So, if I play along and see how things pan out—"
"Let me guess," Vanity yowled and clenched peerless fists. "You gorgeous balloon! She's not marrying you to qualify for immigration! I saw her moon at thee with yearning eyes, the copper-bottomed coos! Superstitious whim, he says. She wants to get you in the bushes and cry, 'Carnival!' like all the rest of them."
"Nay, 'tis but religious mystical union." Avery looked shocked. "A formal matter, huh, Master Shafto?"
"Don't know about that, ding-a-ding-dee,"
quoth Solomon, shaking matted locks.
"Heathen legend do say that when the great white god, that's he, be come to Kohaku-Gizlin, he shall wed Princess of the Sun, that's she, on account to he be divinely powered to bestow wheels on the land, you see. Arr, ye can make wheels, Meister?"
"With much ease," said Avery. "'Tis but matter of shaping wood choicely seasoned, attaching thereto spokes of ash, or such native timber as may serve, then forging rim of metal, the which, when heated, is placed o'er all, and cooling doth contract. As to the axle..." He caught Vanity's eye on him and stopped with an apologetic cough, whereon Solomon resumed,
"God and princess be wed, we all pomp by the high priest, and there be great and joyous feastin',"
he chuckled reminiscently,
"like to weddin' breakfast, when Squire Cobbold were spliced wi' young Mistress Winthrop at St. Maggot's Church 40 year gone. A hoydenish piece she wore, and cuckolded he with a gamekeeper. but 'twore a grand spread, I mind, with pies and pasties, and jellies of grape and turnip, and the dripping flowed like lava from a Mexican volcano."
"You see, fond love," smiled Avery, "nothing to it."
"And when God and princess be hitched, there follows the fructifying of the daughter of the sun for 3 days and nights."
"I knew it,"
yipped Vanity. But ere she could give vent properly, there came an unexpected interruption.
"Hold on, Grandad," said Blood, frowning. "You say these red sticks don't know how to make wheels, and whoever can show 'em they'll accept as God."
"How, sirrah?" Avery's brow was dark. "Wouldst horn in, ha?" But Blood waved him to silence, and looked narrow-eyed on Solomon.
"How come," said he, "when you fell in among these natives, you didn't make wheels for 'em yourself? You could have been the great white god, surely, and been worshipped and lain soft o' nights wi' long tall Sally in the feathers. But instead, you're content all these years to live in rags and grub among the beans and brussels. No way, eh, Slippery Sol?"
Solomon grimaced and shuffled uneasily.
Us can't make wheels no ways. Us forgot how, see? Hoopily hoot."
"Forgot," scoffed Blood, and so patent was the castaway's falsehood that Vanity and Avery stood arrested, watching as he plucked nervously at his rags.
"Princess didn't fancy me," he squealed shifty-eyed. Poor old Sol ain't a big rackety blade like the cap'n here. And I were married already, see? On little Moll Trattleworthy, as minded Gaffer Tovey's pig, so fiddly-dapple to you and chance it."
Seeing Blood's scornful smile, he began to gibber.
"And I didn't want no heathen dame with long slinky legs and lovesome lips, be a belly button never so cute. So there. And I like gardening and compost heaps and clods with worms a-wriggle."
He shrieked as Blood grabbed him by the throat.
"Leave us be!"
"The truth, Scarecrow," snapped the colonel, shaking him. And suddenly Solomon seemed to shrivel and whimpered piteously.
"Don't hurt poor Sol, please, Meister. I'll tell ye. I didn't want to die, that's why. It's the truth. For arter his 3 days fructifying with the princess, these savages do dispatch the great white god as sacrifice to the sun. Aye, by hellish disembowelment on the altar stone. And then they serve it up for dinner. Mejummed well done, slut-a-cum-gush. That minds me," he pawed pathetically at Blood's sleeve. "He wouldn't have a crust and a smidgen a-drippin' for poor Sol, matey."
There was a longish pause in which Vanity swayed white-faced. Blood whistled noiselessly, and Avery finally cleared his throat. "I see," he said. "Well, that puts a slightly different complexion on things, of course."
"Oh, Ben!" Vanity rushed to her lover's side. "Ben, my darling, they shan't serve you up. Not medium to well done."
"Nay, honey bunch," Avery scooped her soothingly against his ruffles and flashed teeth in fighting smile. "Now that I have thee again, shall I wind up 'twixt the fish and the after-eights? I trow not. At worst we shall fight our way clear. We be two stout blades, the colonel and I. Assuming," and he shot Blood a stern glance, "that the blighter's prepared to pull his weight for once. Aye, and it may be we shall have Black Sheba's aid in the pinch."
"Hey!" Vanity snapped upright like whalebone. "What? Sheba?"
"She's out in the woods somewhere. I rescued her from a Spanish dungeon a couple of nights back," Avery added carelessly. "And it may be some spark of gratitude animates yon dusky bosom."
"Never mind yon dusky bosom," shrilled Vanity. "What were you doing rescuing her from dungeons, when for all you knew I was twiddling my thumbs on the Isle of Ruddy Aves?"
"Why, it so fell out, poppet mine, and why I think she may lend a hand now is the way she rallied round after we'd scaped the dons. Open my eyes, I can tell you. I'd taken a crack on the roof, you see, and she carried me, wounded, through the jungle, in her stilettos, mind you, to a secluded glade where she nursed my hurts with rare skill. Ah, but 'tis too long a tale for now, and strange enough to strain belief."
"I'll bet. Suppose you take it from the top. I'm all ears."
"Why then, sweetkin, if you must. There was this galleon I had taken, wherein was fair young Spanish popsy Donna Mellifluer. Oh, you'd like her, Vanity. Such a brave, sweet little soul. Not a day over 16, but what a cracking spirit!" Avery sighed grimly. "Aye, poor child, condemned by reason o' her fresh young beauty to a loveless marriage, and begged me to save her, which I jolly well will, too. Anyway, what's up, precious?"
For Lady Vanity had reeled back with a wordless wail into the sardonic arms of Colonel Blood, and ere Avery could inquire further, who should tool in but Brasso, accompanied by temple guards, and Solomon passed on the news that the Sun Princess required the presence of the great white god, presumably for a wedding rehearsal, and a chat with the vicar. Avery took it like a man.
"I must tread delicately," said he. "Not to worry, folks. Chin's up." He bestowed a gallant smile on Vanity, who had sunk to the sofa with her head in her hands, and marched out, ready for anything. As the brazen door clanged shut, Vanity gave a great woof of numb despair, and raised bewildered blue eyes to heaven.
"What the hell have they been feeding him?" she apostrophized the ceiling. "He rescues me from hideous fate, vows me eternal love, and now I find he's been playing Galahad to some 16-year-old groupie in matador pants, to say nothing of barging into dungeons after that oversexed fugitive from the Hot Mikado, who seems to have carried him on her back halfway across South America to nurse him. In a jungle glade, forsooth, and now he springs hotfoot from my side to the Queen of the Mardi Gras. Nay, 'tis more than simple English maid can bear. Ah, my heart tells me he is true, yet on the face of it he carries on like some souped-up Solomon. And I don't mean him," she added, indicating the castaway who was standing around looking squalid. "What did I tell you?" murmured the colonel. "Sure, and he thought to be in some sort of home. The man's not safe." "What am I to think?" Vanity flung up her arms, and then all the pride and passion of Cheltenham ladies reasserted itself. "I know this much. If he goes through with marrying that man-eating rumba dancer, I've had it with him and his godlike profile, and I hope they serve him up with Duchess potatoes and an apple in his mouth."
At which the colonel made so bold as to pat her shoulder, what time he smiled and stroked his clarky moustache. The Princess of the Sun unsteadily paced her luxurious boudoir, a prey to remorse and cold turkey. Not for hours had she had a fix of drinking chocolate, and the gremlins were getting to her. She twitched and shuddered as she swayed to and fro in her wonted conga rhythm, automatically muttering, "One and two and three, boom," and pausing only occasionally to glance in her mirror and scream, as who wouldn't at the reflection of a pink mongoose in a fruit hat. "Oh, brother," she whimpered, "I wish I was back in Compeche." But the real trouble was her conscience, dulled these many years by the insidious Cohocoguzlin Gooftalk. When first, as a runaway novice nun, she had strayed among the Indians and been hailed as Sun Princess on the strength of her million-dollar legs and skill in Latin American dancing, she had become addicted to the novel chocolate dust, sniffing it, rubbing it in night and morning, dabbing it behind her ears, even having her handmaidens, who were sworn to secrecy, shoot it at her from blowpipes. She had done everything but drink it, and the years had slipped by in a cocoa-colored haze, until yesterday, when she had fallen madly in love with a fair Superman who might have been designed by Michelangelo and trained at Stillman's gym, and without thought had proclaimed him great white god and bridegroom before the Cohocoguzlins assembled. Aflame with pure infatuation, she had determined to kick the habit. But now, as she emerged from her stoned state, returning sanity brought with it a realization of what she had done. By claiming her mate, she had condemned him to death. She would have him for 3 days of wild passion. She went goose-pimply at the thought. And then he would be taken from her, and she would never see him again, except as a nourishing fricassee. It was catch-22. Small wonder that the proud daughter of the Sun cried aloud and hurled her fruit headdress against the wall before subsiding in despair on her couch. In her frenzy, she had smashed quite a bit of furniture, and the noise summoned her chief attendant and confidant, a worldly little tomato, who had fled the convent with her and shared her fortunes ever since. She surveyed the wreckage with a sympathetic eye and inquired, "Monkey on your back, sweetie. Want I should hit you?" In broken whispers, in case anyone should overhear and realize that her official Tarzan accent was a phony, the princess explained her dilemma. "I have doomed him, Prisitlinton, that superb man-god with his curly hair and dimples. My arms ache for him, but ever they enfold him, he is scheduled for the chef. Ah, pity me, what am I to do?" "Have a 3-day honeymoon and forget it," counseled Prisitlinton. "Once you're back on the chocolate, you'll never give him another thought."
wailed the princess. "There is no drug powerful enough to drown the remorse I should feel. Oh, God, I could do with a blast, maybe just a teensy little one. No, no, I must be strong. Prisitlinton, I can't do it. I must forego his embraces in order to save him."
"Get up to date, O daughter of Montezuma," said the practical handmaid. "If you backtrack now and say he isn't the god, they'll just stick him over the Magway anyway, and they might start asking themselves if you're the girl for the job." She patted her mistress's shoulder. "Go on, pamper yourself, honey. You can skip the main course at the feast." The princess hurtled upright, her lovely midriff streaked with tears. "I must get him away," she cried wildly. "If I can't have him, at least I'll know that I set him free. Help me, sweet Prisitlin, as you love me, how can I bust him out of here?" "Have you been at the hash behind my back?" Prisitlin was suspicious. "You're serious. Next thing you know, you'll be wanting to go with him." "And give up drinking chocolate permanently?" cried the princess, round-eyed. "Oh, come on!" She clutched her brow in perplexity. "There must be a way to help him fly the coop.
disguise, laundry baskets, a garbage truck. Think, Prisitlidlin, you dumb bitch, think.
There's the slave traders, said Prisitlidlin doubtfully. You know, that half-caste gang who come every 6 months to buy our vagrants and used-up priests? They'd smuggle them out, if you made it worth their while.
The slavers! The princess tried to bite her lip, but missed.
Ah, what a hideous fate! And yet better than going into the oven at Gas Mark 7, surely! At least his death would not lie on my conscience.
She closed her eyes in anguish, opened them again, and shrieked,
Where am I? Who are you, woman? Why doesn't the floor lie down? Oh, I remember. Yes, do it. Do it, Prisitlidlin.
Go secretly to the slavers and make a deal. Tell them we'll sell them Brasso next time round. Anything.
I'm on my way, said Prisitlidlin obediently. But I still think you're looped. 3 nights in paradise you're passing up, remember?
All right, I'm going.
And while I'm gone, suppose you have the great white god put in the hall of Quetzalcoatl alone.
The princess was baffled.
To what end?
And why are these green beetles doing a square dance on my coverlet?
We've got to get him alone so the slavers can make a clean snatch, don't we? Cried Prisitlidlin impatiently. Say it so he can contemplate his divinity or something. And tomorrow we'll tell the peasants the sun god couldn't wait to claim him and drew him up to heaven in a gilded chariot drawn by green beetles, for Christ's sake. They'll buy any story if it's goofy enough. Then you'll be off the hook and back on the sauce, if I know anything.
Dear Prisitlidlin, you think of everything, palpitated the princess tearfully. Stick me with a fix before you split, will you? The blowpipe's on my makeup tray.
So now we have Prisitlidlin speeding through the darkened streets on her way towards the slavers' camp, Captain Avery answering the summons to the great shadowy hall of Quetzalcoatl, and out in the surrounding jungle. What, huh? Can that be an elegant black figure whose trouser suit needs invisible mending and a dry clean? See, it crouches in the loom of a step pyramid, rapier in hand, eyes and fingernails fairly agleam in the moonlight. Black Sheba is on her way to mount a one-woman rescue of Captain Avery, wheresoe'er he may be. It's astonishing what women will do for our hero, and one can only hope that whatever it is he's got, the government let him keep it. But hist! Still deeper in the jungle, on a shadowy trail, a light blinks, metal clanks softly, and there is the muffled sound of stealthy feet, as of a great disciplined multitude, tripping over things in the dark and walking into trees. Surely it isn't the slave traders. No, they're over there, in the opposite direction, swarthy ruffians listening agog round their campfire to the urgings of fair Prisitlidlin, nodding grim assent to her proposal, sealing the bargain with an invitation to join them in rum sodas and a game of strip pontoon, which she declines, bidding them haste to do the princess's bidding. Here they come now, half a dozen hairy, unwashed half-breeds with hankies round their brows and slave shackles in their back pockets, sneaking along behind Prisitlidlin, who points ahead through the gloom to the distant temple and the adjacent hall of Quetzalcoatl. The slavers give her the thumbs up, and she slips away through the darkness to rejoin her mistress.
What about the armed multitude, then? Easy does it. We shall know more of them anon.
All right, then. They're Spanish soldiers from Cartagena, with arquebuses primed, d'ye see, and naked blades preparing a camisado, which is not a highly seasoned Catalonian stew, but a night attack, so called because they wore their shirts over their armor.
Education, by the powers, but mum.
Prisitlidlin
buzzed through the silent temple passages and upstairs to a certain secluded balcony where, she had guessed, the princess would be found. Sure enough, a feathered skirt was rustling in the shadows, and a liquid contralto was whispering, "Aye, what's that number? Aye, Cuban rumba," as the princess, her tissues restored by a mammoth blast of chocolate, which had reduced her pupils to the size of mill wheels, undulated silently in an alcove where she could look down through a cunning screen at the vast hall of Katzlotzelbottle, far below, where a solitary but clean-cut figure paced to and fro, carelessly whistling, "When you walk through a storm." Pritzelitlin joined her mistress and glanced down cynically. "Couldn't resist a last peek, eh? We'll make the most of it, 'cause the banana bunch are closing in. 2 minutes and counting."
"Isn't he gorgeous?" breathed the princess, starry-eyed. "That tawny hair, those shoulders. Oh, God, if he turns that profile to the torchlight again, I'll freak. And I'm letting him go. I need my chocolate-injected head examined. Couldn't the slavers lift him after the 3 days and nights? I mean, look at the way he moves. Oh, oh, oh!"
"He could scratch my back," admitted Pritzelitzelklin. "But it's too late now, All Highest. List!" From somewhere far below came the unmistakable sound of a drowsy Indian sentry being sapped, and the figure in the hall stopped whistling, every nerve alert.
"Get the alertness of those nerves," hissed the princess. "Hell, he's perfect."
"Hist!" whispered Pritzelitlin, and frowned, trying to think of a word ending in ist that meant look. Baffled, she pointed, and the two women clung to each other and stared with bated breath. A door in the hall below had opened. Captain Avery drew himself up. He had been kept waiting in this great gloomy place for several minutes, and princess or no princess, he was thinking impatiently, it wasn't good enough. And who came here, this unwashed half-breed with tangled locks, sneaking furtively towards him with dubious intent? One of the temple's staff? A cleaner, possibly. "Evenin', Mac," whispered the half-breed with a snaggle-toothed grin. "Gor a light?" He held up a half-smoked cigarillo, and the captain relaxed and made a polite token search of his pockets, since he was quite sure he hadn't a light on him. And out of the shadows leaped five grunting figures with club, sack, and ropes. "Hijacked," thought Avery, too late, as something exploded on his skull, and it was pure reflex action on his part that sent two of his attackers sprawling ere he sank senseless with a murmur of, "Sorry, I don't seem to have," and was back picking primroses by the river's brim again. The slavers bundled him up and were out and running with him in a trice, and far above, the Princess of the Sun heaved a great sob and drooped in her feathers. "Gone," she glooped, and listlessly plucked and ate a mango from her headdress. "The only man I ever loved, and I never even saw him conquer." Pritzelitlin regarded her with eyes of cow-like compassion. "Don't bear down, favored child of the sun god," she coaxed. "We'll get over it. He's just a rag and a bone and a hank of whatever the hell. And listen," she confided, "I've got something'll blow what's left of your disintegrated mind." She stooped to whisper, "Malted chocolate dust. Crazy about it." The slavers legged it through the jungly night, nor paused till they had reached a river and bestowed their precious cargo on their barge, which they warped hastily downstream. Just in time, too, for the sound of marching feet and the smell of smoldering arquebus fuses was getting closer. See where the lights gleam in the undergrowth as the Spaniards close in on sleepy Cohacalguzlan. But why? What's Cohacalguzlan done? To a jungle clearing where slaves stagger under the weight of three enormous sedan chairs, closely guarded by Morianed pikemen. Two of the chairs were deluxe eight slave jobs with ivory trim, and contained Don Lardo Baluna and his intended bride. The third sedan, a light sports model with two groaning carriers, contained Enchilada the Chamberlain. The viceroy was all in gleaming black armor, his face alight with hideous glee as he stroked a live black mamba in his steel gauntlets. Mellifluo, poor lady, slumped gracefully in the height of night jungle fashion, cloth of gold camouflaged gown, matching accessories, and a mosquito veil of priceless Mechlin lace. Dusky attendants fanned her and proffered cooling drinks, which went unheeded.
Excellency, Enchilada, having conferred with the military commander, was reporting, all greasy excitement, we hit pay dirt, I think. The scouts say we are approaching the lost city of Kohakalguzlin, famous for gold, bloodthirsty natives, and repulsive works of art. Also, the dumb bums don't know about wheels, even. It's the only lost city around here, so you bet your sweet bippy some of the pirate fugitives will have taken refuge, you know.
Gold, you say? Lisped Don Lardo greedily. Just what we need to finance my great crusade through the Indies. We shall fall upon it, put it to the sack, slaughter without ruth or pity. They make lousy slaves anyway, and we haven't time to waste converting them to the true faith. His dentures wobbled alarmingly as he turned mad, gleaming eyes on his lovely consort.
You hear, Mellifluo angel, what Hubby Wubby has in store for you? A whole savage civilization to exterminate and cast down, not one stone left on another. Aren't you glad I persuaded you to come?
Mellifluo fluttered limp eyelids and gestured weakly. Persuaded, yet. For days and nights she had been toted along on this nightmare journey, with servants, portable dressing room and bath, and even her own private collapsible four-poster in tow. This leering monster had sworn he could not bear to be parted from her for an instant, and had gloated about the carnage he would wreak for her amusement. And she was to marry this sanguinary loony? Santa Maria!
Please, Don Lardo, she began weakly.
Lardo, honey, hissed the viceroy, snapping his black mamba like a whip. You remember, sweet Mellifluo?
Ah, forgive me, faltered the bewildered Hidalga. Lardo, honey, I mean... This Indian town, couldn't we spare some of them, maybe? The little ones and the old people, just for me, please?
Spare them? Don Lardo goggled horribly. Ah, you mean for torture and burning at auto da fe? Why, that's a terrific cara mia, brilliant! She's brilliant, I say. Isn't she brilliant, you bastards? He roared, lashing with his snake at the headquarters officers, who obediently chorused, "She's terrific, just like you!"
"Pass me a new snake, Enchilada," purred the viceroy. "This one's gone all squishy and doesn't crack anymore.
All right, scum, what are you waiting for? Attack, kill, burn! Throw discipline to the winds, their endemonized heathen! Loot their temples, plunder their cellars, desecrate their altars in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost! We've got protection, I tell you. You'll all be absolved later, as soon as the accountants are through. On in the king's name for the glory of Spain!"
So now were enthusiastic cries of Viva el sac and pillage, and Caramba, I can't wait, and Let's hear it for Lardo, as the eager soldiery pressed through the jungle until, in the baleful moonlight, they beheld the ghostly outlines of step pyramids and temples, and halted on the forest edge for a pause for suspense before the final assault. The soldiers bit their nails, and the officers checked their watches, and a terrible silence
fell on the scene, a silence that seemed to steal forward on the town like an ugly ghost, stifling even the light breaths of sleepers, muffling the heartbeats, the silence of approaching doom. Black Sheba felt it as she prowled the deserted alleys and stopped, rapier in hand, the sweat icy on her perfect spine. In the bedchamber of the princess, Prisitlitlin sensed it and shivered uneasily as she laid syringe and chocotoke capsules on the bedside table of her drowsy mistress. It penetrated even to the room where Vanity waited anxiously, wondering, one, was Avery in deadly danger? Two, if not, was the princess showing him how the feathers worked on her conga skirt? Blood, his rascally instincts suddenly alert, stopped his pacing to listen, and Solomon Shafto, huddled in his rags in a corner, dreaming of dripping, suddenly sat bolt upright and croaked, "Vuldioidoi! Old Sol smells garlic adrift on the night air with a curse, and dang it, the dons be come! The damned dons, I tell 'ee, take to the hills!" To confirm his diagnosis came sudden uproar of gunfire and musketry as the Spaniards stormed into the town, their morphological oaths mingling with the cries of the inhabitants, who woke to find themselves beset by the forces of civilization. What followed was awful. The Spaniards rushed about, shooting and slashing, breaking windows, turning on taps, blocking drains in wanton fashion, and shouting, "Wakey, wakey, you wugs! Stand by your beds for slaughtering! It's sack the city time!" Sheba, in her alley, was suddenly confronted by a mob of pike-wielding infantry, who recognized her instantly with cries of, "'Tis the fugitive Coon Lady! Seize her!" She turned at bay, and her bright steel sent two to their account ere the others bore her down, breathed all over her to the point of suffocation, and trussed her hand and foot before rampaging on to break more bottles, stove in the heads of casks, knock at doors and run away, and put the entire population to the sword. Amidst the furor, only the cacique Brasso kept his head. As soon as he saw that all was lost, he summoned a hasty meeting of community leaders in the temple, announced that the situation was in hand, and that the sun god's intervention on Kohaku Guzlin's behalf could be expected any minute, urged stout resistance, and promised that the princess would issue an official statement shortly. Reassured, the citizens waited obediently to be massacred, which they were, while Brasso scooted to the royal apartments, where a distinctly woozy princess was being tended by panic-stricken handmaidens. Brasso informed them that they must convey their mistress to the secret VIP fallout shelter beneath the great altar without delay. "But keeper of the high mysteries," faltered Prisiltlin, "her highness is stone to Helen gone and cannot locomote." "Just because she ain't fitted with handles don't mean she can't be carried," snarled Brasso. "Up, up and away, girls!" "But she will wish to share the fate of her people." 12 will get you 7, she don't. "Look, don't give me no grief, Beulah," warned Brasso. "She owes it to her people to survive, right? Man, who else is going to be the repository of their culture and traditions and stuff? Who else is going to carry on the dynasty?" "What dynasty?" asked Prisiltlin, as the comatose princess was borne hastily to the high altar. "The dynasty she and me is going to found," chuckled Brasso wickedly. "Listen, don't knock this invasion. That ruckus out there is the priestly hierarchy getting theirs, along with most of the population. So they get thinned, so what? People, they're everywhere. But we survive, and when we come out, baby, we're going to start this civilization all over again, with Brasso top of the power vacuum, okay? Hurry along, ladies. And another thing, you can forget all this sun god crap. That's out. It's King Brasso and the Sun Princess, in that order." It may have been a Spanish cannon shot, or just wear and tear, but at that instant, the gigantic statue of the sun god toppled from its plinth and squashed Brasso, flatter than a fluke. The handmaidens screamed and swooned, but Prisiltlin rallied them, and they got the princess below stairs and closed the hatch.
So it was that they alone survived the carnage, and no doubt emerged eventually, safe and sound, for rumors still persist in the jungles of the Maine of a lost all-female civilization given to rumbas and worshipping drinking chocolate. But whether the legend be true, no one knows, for Kohaku-Guzlan's temples and pyramids vanished long ago neath the engulfing tropic forest, and no explorers have found it to this day, or pondered the mystery of the rejected wheel prototypes which litter its silent courts and weed-choked plazas. Meanwhile, in the chamber where she and her companions were confined, Vanity was a prey to mounting consternation as the sounds of massacre and pillage drew nearer. "Look, is my hair an awful mess?" she cried to Blood. "And this dress is a positive fright. Ah, what will our Spanish rescuers think to see a lady of quality thus reduced?" "I can guess," snapped Blood. "You're mighty confident they'll rescue us. From what I know of them, they're a pack of papist rapists. In no way tender or heretics, ladies or not. Listen, Akushla, I can pass myself off as a left-footer, so I can, and if I give him a touch of the Pax Vobiscums, and we pretend to be man and wife," he added with a meaning smirk, "then haply I may be able to preserve thy sweet person from ill usage." "Faugh! A distasteful subterfuge, and who needs it?" cried haughty Vanity. "Dagos are remarkably civilized. Why, we had their ambassador's daughter in the upper fifth. Onions, we called her. A stuck-up minx with spots who sneaked about our vodka at the dorm feast. But that's not the point. Their officers will be caballeros who will show all courtesy to a lady of my station." She looked Blood up and down. "It'll be more convincing if I say you're my groom. Right, leave the talking to me." And as the door crashed open to admit a pack of blood-drunk Spaniards brandishing reeking swords, the admiral's daughter rapped sharply on a convenient table. "Pay attention! I am Lady Vanity Rook, an English noblewoman held captive by these beastly savages. Where is your officer?" A swarthy lout in a morion stopped brandishing to scratch his stubbled chin and scowl at her. "English?" he demanded truculently. "You got a passport?" "Do I look as though I've got a passport?" retorted Vanity. "So, an illegal immigrant," sneered the Spaniard. "Camarados, we got a bunch of wetbacks here. No passports, huh? Okay. You got any animal foodstuffs, uncooked meats, growing plants, raw vegetables?" "Arr, plants, is it?" cried Solomon Shafto, hobbling forward, his knuckle to his brow. "Old souls, your man, senor, bedding out and dung spreading a specialty with a ding-dang-diddle, but likewise herbaceous borders and landscaping of cabbages, looky." "Hold your tongue, hobbledy-hoy," grated Vanity, and to the Spaniard, "I demand to be taken to your commander at once." "Please," added Blood ingratiatingly, and the Spaniard scowled thunderously. "Please, you say? You trying to soft-soap Corporal Gomez, gringo pig? Ha! I know your sort. You English, you try to sneak into our country, try to take a jobs from honest Spanish working people, like he wants to be a cabbage landscaper, the old bum, and the dame wants to be a topless waitress, maybe, and you with your clerky mustache and your please, you want to set up as a pimp, I bet. You think," he roared indignantly, "we don't got cabbage landscapers and topless waitresses and pimps of our own. Who needed the work, huh?" His followers growled menacingly. "You got a nerve, gringo. No passports, huh? Okay." Vanity stamped with vexation. Blood protested, and Solomon groveled all at once. But Corporal Gomez silenced them with an angry gesture. "You ask for it, wetbacks. Okay, I was just a-going to molest the dame and then slit all of your throats. But now I fix you good. You go before Don Lardo himself and see how you like it. Away with them bravos!" The hapless trio were hustled rudely out into the smoking ruin to which the raiders had reduced Kohaku-Guzlan.
There were corpses everywhere, and Don Lardo had spent an enjoyable dawn reviewing the slaughter, and had returned with blood all over his boots to take part in a Te Deum and breakfast, and gloat over the huge pile of ornaments, jewelry, and native works of art before his pavilion. Cackling with glee, he had bounced up and down on the princess's magnificent litter in full armor, a sight which had quite put Donna Mellifluo off her toast and cereal, and sent her shuddering to the refuge of her own pavilion. But now a nasty shock awaited the viceroy. It transpired that to their inability to design wheels, the unfortunate Cohuckle Gislins had added a total ignorance of precious metals. For the vast heap of treasure glowing dully in the morning sun proved, on closer examination, to be not gold, but brass. Even the litter was made in Taiwan. The viceroy's rage was awesome. "They've cheated me, these aboriginal swine!" He shook steel fists to heaven and stamped his black mamba underfoot. "It passeth belief! Honest conquistadores go to vast outlay and inconvenience to bring enlightenment to these vermin, expecting only a modest return to defray expenses, and what do we get? Junk!" he wheeled, frothing on enchilada. "I'll make them pay, por Dios! They'll feel my vengeance! Kill them! Massacre them, all the heathen reptiles!"
"But, boss, we just did,"
faltered the chamberlain.
"Are you trying to make trouble again?" blared Don Lardo. "Scour the woods, look under beds, discover trembling survivors. Fool, whoever heard of a massacre where some old crone or village idiot didn't get overlooked? Find them. I want to see them slaughtered while I have my boiled eggs. And then I'll have her," he pointed a passionate finger at Sheba, who stood smoldering defiantly between her guards, "crucified with the toast and marmalade, and a double orange juice and black coffee, damn you! But ha! Who are these?"
For Corporal Gomez and his three prisoners had hove in sight, and the viceroy's gooseberry eyes widened alarmingly when he learned that they were English captives of the Indians, one of whom claimed to be the daughter of an English milord admiral, no less. Enchilada looked to see these heretics disposed of in swift and novel fashion, but to his amazement, Don Lardo, after chewing his steel gauntlets in brief thought, suddenly contorted his features into a ghastly smile and addressed Vanity in his most ingratiatory hiss.
"But how distressing! An English lady of quality in the hands of these infidels! Dear Madonna," he bowed his enormous armored bulk, "I can only rejoice that Providence hath made me the instrument of your deliverance. Pray be seated, and refresh yourself, while you tell us what terrible misfortune led to your captivity."
"She's got no passport," announced Corporal Gomez, "and the other two bums are a pimp and a cabbage landscaper."
Don Lardo fractured his skull with a light backhand flick of his steel gauntlet, and simpered ghoulishly at Vanity.
"Forgive my peasant soldiery," he lisped. "Enchilada, wine for the lady, and have the corporal swept up. And now, Madonna, we are all ears."
"What's this? Don Lardo being nice? Ah, but you see, paranoid nut though he was, he still knew a heroine when he saw one, and the aristocratic breeding of this sculpted blonde in the velvet rags stuck out like a cauliflower ear. And what should a Spanish villain do with a heroine but lull her with honeyed words? It was part of their training, practically. As for Vanity, she had been through a lot lately, and to be kindly entreated, even by something that looked like King Kong with a stomach upset, had a disarming effect on her. Bewildered, she sipped the wine they gave her, and then briefly sketched the essentials of her adventures, how she had fallen into the hands of pirates, and then of Indians who would have sacrificed her, but for the timely intervention of her fiancé, one Captain Avery, about whom she now expressed a touching anxiety.
"Avery, Avery,"
murmured subtle Dunlardo. "Do I remember the name, Enchilada? No matter. Thinth he in the vicinity, our search party will surely find him." He leered and poured more wine, and despite his Latin courtesy, Vanity could not repress uneasy goose pimples. "Gosh, what a clock," she thought, "but at least he's civil." "Your father, the Admiral Lord Rook," continued the Viceroy, "no doubt commands a fleet of ships. Is he, in Caribbean waters at the moment?" "Alack, poor Daddy!" cried Vanity. "I last saw him in a rowing boat in the Indian Ocean, and know not wheresoe'er he may be." "We must pray for his safety," crooned Dunlardo, with his most charming smile, which would have curdled petrol. "And the pirates bore you from the Indian Ocean to New Spain. What an ordeal for one so young and fair!" "Oh, well, it was just a bit hairy now and then," admitted Vanity modestly. "Actually, Captain Pugh was quite cute in a froggy sort of way. It was when he came ashore to bury his treasure that the Indians got hold of me." "Treasure?" Dunlardo's raised eyebrows crackled like kindling, and his dentures rattled with animation. "Oh, he had a booty?" "You can double that in spades," said Vanity, and Blood, who had been listening uneasily, felt a wild foreboding. "Why, they must have robbed a bank. I mean, they had absolute scads of the stuff. Gold, I warrant me, in vast shining heaps." "Which they buried?" "Why, its true owners will rejoice to have it restored, and be truly grateful to you, Madonna, who knows where it is to be found." "Who, me?" Vanity was round-eyed. "Gosh, I've no idea, I'm afraid. Somewhere on a beach, not far from here. But I'm hopeless at geography. My man Blood," she indicated the colonel, who was mentally having pups, "could probably find the spot, couldn't you, Blood?" The colonel's marrow froze as the gargoyle face of the viceroy was turned in his direction. All his courtly Spanish grace hadn't fooled our Tom for a minute, and as he was both apprehensive and sick as mud at Vanity's mention of the Happy Dan treasure, of whose location he had a very fair idea. Indeed, he had been dreaming of the day when, assuming he ever got out of this ghastly succession of crises, he might dig it up personally. That hope died before Dunlardo's frightful regard, but Blood did his desperate best to play dumb, and Irish dumb at that.
"What's that, your leddyship? Treasure, is it? Sure, and how would I be knowing that can't tell latitude from t'other thing? Faith and begob—"
"Blood, eh?" The viceroy's voice was silky smooth. "An appropriate name, I think. Enchilada, would you be so good as to send for 4 horses and attach them with stout cords to this tall rascal's several limbs? Perhaps we can stimulate his memory, or Madonna's." And with a sudden dreadful baying laugh, Dunlardo thrust his face towards Vanity, who paled in panic.
"No, no," she fluttered. "What, eh? Oh, golly!"
"Ha, ha!" bawled the viceroy in triumph, and springing to his feet, he drummed his gauntlets on his breastplate. "I've done it again! Caramba, what a genius! See, Enchilada, what good manners and Castilian subtlety can achieve. Instinct told me that if I wooed this peroxided heretic slut with fair words, she would spill something good. And what do I learn? Not only that her fool of a father is half a world away, which means one less enemy fleet to worry about, but that a vast treasure is available to finance my great crusade." He strode up and down, clanging exultantly, his dentures flying out to be crushed neath his armored feet. "You lot would have ravished her and butchered her buddies according to the book, wouldn't you? But not Lardo. I've got it here." And he clashed his steel forefinger against his helmet. "That's why I'm a viceroy and you're not. Now all we have to do is tear this lout apart between galloping horses, and he'll sing like a bird.
Santiago, I'll have 4 boiled eggs on the strength of this. Bring on the ponies!"
In a trice, blood had been flung down by brutal soldiers and neatly attached by wrists and ankles to 4 mettlesome chargers, whose riders waited eagerly for Don Lardo's signal. The viceroy was in a frenzy of self-congratulation, mitting his assembled troops, who, under Enchilada's frantic cheerleading, flung up their morions in acclaim. Heedless of the tinned hats which rained around her, Vanity fronted the armored giant in fearless fury.
"Oh, base!" she shrilled. "So to impose on a lady in distress with fair words and foul, sticky wine? Well, I'd sooner have the new Beaujolais, so there! Of all the mean tricks to wheedle information out of me unaware, and I thought you were a gentleman. Fie, you stinker! Know that I am a British subject, so is he, for that matter."
She indicated Blood, who was creaking slightly as the riders took up the slack.
"And unless you release us with handsome apologies, 'twill be the worse for you."
For a moment it seemed that Don Lardo would dash her to the ground with one sweep of his armored hand, but a shower of falling morions impeded him long enough to regain his cool. He seized her proud chin twixt cruel metal fingers.
"Snarl at me, would you, Lutheran whelp? Aye, but I'll give you cause. When your fellow there hath spoken his piece, and I have that pirate hoard for my war chest, you shall see how much protection your precious British crown can afford you, or any other of your heretic brood. For not only shall I cleanse the American seas of the pirate filth, but every foreign settlement with them, English, Dutch, French, Walloon, Skowegian."
"Don't forget flags of convenience, Excellency," put in Enchilada.
"All of them! Every vile interloper who does not acknowledge the sovereignty and supremacy of Spain,"
bawled Don Lardo. "My fleets shall sweep from the Florida Keys to the Amazon. My armies shall make rubble of your limy frog and squarehead outpost, and no man, woman, child, or farmyard animal shall remain. Now, Spain shall extend from Canada to the southernmost seas, and the tides that wash the Antilles shall be crimson with Protestant blood.
Which reminds me," he roared to the 4 horsemen, "take the strain when I say heave."
"Do your worst,"
cried the indomitable Vanity.
"Wait your hurry," thundered Don Lardo. "I'm not finished yet. Where was I? Ah, poor los entrañas de Dios."
"The Antilles shall be crimson," prompted Enchilada.
"Right!"
Don Lardo gloated down at his fair prisoner. "And when I sail on my great crusade of the earth to purge the new world of your northern corruption, I shall take you with me, proud admiral's daughter, to afford me amusement on the voyage. You will make a piquant change from yon dusky charmer over the way."
"One for the odd days, one for the evens," chortled Enchilada. "Good thinking, boss."
Even in her fraught situation, Vanity could not suppress a yip of astonishment as her eye fell on Sheba for the first time.
"'Tis she, her, that woman who filched my Helena Rubinstein and had designs on my darling Ben. Where is he, you horrid wench?"
"You should worry," sneered Sheba. "We are not like to speak him this voyage."
"Nay," cried Vanity frantically, "he's around some place, and will haste to my aid."
"You'd like to think so, wouldn't you?" Sheba taunted, spiteful to the last. "'Twas not your milky softness that he rescued from Dago dungeon. If he hastes to anyone's aid, 'twill be—"
"Stop them! Gag them!"
screamed Don Lardo, his eyes rolling horribly as he clutched his temples.
"Do something, Enchilada!"
"Can I say something?"
Blood, taut in his bonds, spoke in an anguished voice.
"Yes!"
shouted Don Lardo, recalled to the business in hand.
"You can scream, unless you reveal this instant where I may find the treasure trove. Speak, and I spare your miserable life, for the moment anyway. Remain dumb, and you'll be a quintet. Horsemen, on your marks! Ready! Get set!"
The riders steadied their mounts, and the spread-eagled blood squawked as the ropes tightened. Dunlardo cackled fiendishly and swung around on Vanity. "Well, Madonna, will he talk, or will you?" "We will never submit," cried Vanity. "I defy you. So does he. Listen to him, constant to the end. Go on, Colonel. Tell him what he can do with his foreign threats." All eyes turned on Blood, who was twanging like a guitar string. A grimace, which might have been a pain, or defiance, or resignation, or just wind, crossed his tanned features. Then in a voice that rang clear, if somewhat strained, he spoke.
"If you go back up the jungle trail for 7 hours, you'll come to the beach. There's a big palm tree, and you go left a couple of miles, and there'll be bodies all over the place, because that's where Happy Dan's boys got their lumps from the Indians. Right, that's where you start digging."
Well, it's nice to know that all his hardships haven't warped Blood's instinct for self-preservation. Vanity may be disappointed in him, but at least he's still in one piece, as Dunlardo, his dentures secured and his hapless prisoners in tow, sets off to dig up the pirate's treasure and then spread bloody ruin and destruction the length of the Caribbean by the powers. Aye, and who's to stop him? Our hero was last seen helpless in the merciless grip of slave traders. Our female leads are all in the clutches of bestial villainy. Blood's had it up to here and can't be relied on. Solomon Shafto's barmy. The whole pirate fraternity are scattered and dispersed. Goliath probably hasn't even got a new leg yet. And poor old Admiral Rook has spent the whole of Book the Second adrift in the Indian Ocean. Here, that's a bit rough. The old boy's due a few pages, isn't he? After all, he's a peer of the realm and can probably make a ton of trouble if we neglect him much longer. So, knuckling our forehead apologetically, we shall butter him up with a chapter opening all to himself. Aye, and more than a mere chapter, my lord, do you see? For here, by your lordship's favor, endeth the second, and beginneth the last book of The Pirates.